طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. And now on to our feature presentation by Professor Cornel West, giving the keynote speech at the opening session of the annual conference of the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. Cornel West is a professor, author, and scholar who currently teaches at Union Theological Seminary in New York City, previously taught at Princeton and Harvard and the University of Paris. He is also a human rights activist who can be found demonstrating on the streets as well as teaching in the classroom. The program begins with opening statements.
Good morning. Dr. West, thank you so much for joining us today. It's an honor and pleasure to have you back here, and we are really looking forward to your presentation and our discussion with you. And it's also a pleasure, of course, to welcome Saeed Arakat, who is on our Palestine Center Committee and also a prominent Palestinian journalist here in Washington, D.C. So thank you both for joining us, and thank you, Dr. Cornel West. We really appreciate having you here.
It's always a blessing and an honor and a privilege to be back at the Jerusalem Fund with the Palestine Center. I salute you, my dear brother Mohammed, and I salute brother Zaid as well. You all are holding up the blood-stained, tear-soaked banner of truth and justice for a great people, our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters. So I'm just very glad to be here.
Thank you, Dr. West. We are honored. I mean, you know, I can't say it enough. It is always inspiring. It is always amazing to be around you and to look through the prism and to look through the panorama that you convey and you paint out there. So without further ado, sir, we will be, you know, looking forward to listening to you, listening about the parallels between the struggles of Palestinian and African American and those who are struggling to end the yoke of oppression and the yoke of colonialism everywhere in the world. Thank you, sir.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You know, I begin with the notion that we're living in the midst of an American empire that is undergoing spiritual decay and more decrepitude. And that spiritual decay has to do with the increasing callousness toward the vulnerable and escalating indifference toward those who are suffering. So people can easily turn their backs and be concerned just about their individual careers or try to live in the lap of luxury or act as if the wealth inequality, to act as if the white supremacist and male supremacist practices are not kicking in significant ways. Now, by more decrepitude, I mean pushing integrity, intellectual integrity, moral integrity, spiritual integrity to the fringes, pushing honesty, pushing decency, pushing generosity to the peripheral. And so when we talk about the solidarity between Black people and the solidarity between Palestinian people, I always like to cast it through moral and spiritual lens so that we're able to keep track of that spiritual decay and hit it head on, shatter callousness, shatter indifference. We're able to zero in on the moral decrepitude and be able to have practices, bear witnesses to a not just a support of those who are suffering, but to cast a limelight on it, a spotlight on it. So I come to learn and listen, but I also come to try to be a witness of a people, of a Black people, of a great people who have been chronically hated for 400 years and yet has in so many ways taught the world so much about love and what it can do. I think of Martin Luther King Jr.'s love ethic. I think of John Coltrane's Love Supreme. I think of Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. I think of Stevie Wonder's Love and the Need of Love. These are love warriors. And when you love in the way in which you ought, which is say you begin with loving your own family, your own community, and when it's deep enough and mature enough, it spills over to love others. And that includes especially others who are hated, others who are oppressed. And so you can't be a love warrior coming out of the Black freedom movement and not be critical of any ethnic cleansing. It's a crime against humanity. Any occupation, it's a crime against humanity. Any attempt of imposing an ideology, whatever that ideology is, that loses sight of the precious humanity of a slice of our species. And so when we talk about Palestinian solidarity and Black solidarity, for me, we're not primarily talking just about interest. I know that that's the political discourse that many of the pundits and even political theorists highlight. Yes, we are a hated people. Yes, we are oppressed people, and solidarity ought to follow therefrom. But I'm concerned about the moral and the spiritual dimension of this. And so when I come to give my own reflections, I'm trying to highlight the ways in which to be a love warrior in 2021, rooted in the Black freedom tradition that attempts to highlight the love warriors of the past, the Malcolm X, the Fannie Lou Hamer, the Ella Baker. That I cannot understand why we don't have a more massive display of solidarity of Black love warriors with the plight and predicament of our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters. You see, to be terrorized for 400 years and yet to produce freedom fighters like Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and Ida B. Wells Barnett, to be traumatized for 400 years, but produce wounded healers like Louis Armstrong, or like Aretha Franklin. Now, what does it mean to be a love warrior, freedom fighter, and wounded healer in 2021 in relation to the apartheid-like conditions, the West Bank, the subjugation of Gaza, the domination going back to 1948 of the ethnic cleansing? See, these are the kind of questions that not only need to be asked, but they need to be wrestled with and acted on. Now, I think we have to be very, very honest and candid about why there is a reluctance of a number of different Black leaders and even Black freedom fighters to speak unequivocally about the full-fledged humanity of precious Palestinian brothers and sisters, and at the same time be able to understand the narrative of the dispossession of land and being pushed out of one's land, the narrative of the ethnic cleansing, the over 700,000 Arabs in 48 who were forced out of their villages and in their homes, and then the domination of 1967. And let's be very clear about this, that, you know, that the difficulty and the delicacy of wrestling with the plight of our precious Jewish brothers and sisters for 2,000 years, hated and terrorized and traumatized, and therefore understanding themselves primarily as underdogs in pre-modern history, in medieval history, and in modern history in Europe. And the idea then of those people, primarily underdogs, certainly hated, certainly terrorized, certainly traumatized, the idea of them being oppressors in their policies, the idea of them being supported by U.S. policies, by the American empire that would turn its back at those crimes against humanity, the dispossession of land, the ethnic cleansing, the occupation, the discrimination, the debasing, the degrading of Palestinian humanity. And so it becomes an intellectual and an ideological battle, for me, always rooted in morality and spirituality as a revolutionary Christian that I attempt to be. It becomes an intellectual and ideological battle for people to actually understand the way in which our Jewish brothers and sisters became not just overdogs, but became oppressors and occupiers and promoters of dispossession of land and ethnic cleansing. Now, when we say Jewish brothers and sisters, we're not talking about all of them. You and I know that the Jewish community, like any great people, any community, it has variety, diversity, and heterogeneity. Noam Chomsky is our brother. Stanley Aronowitz is our brother. And they are as Jewish as Jesus. But we're talking about Jewish right-wing nationalists. Right. We're talking about centrist Zionists and liberal Zionists who will turn their backs at this massive suffering and misery of precious Palestinians, who will rationalize massive annihilation of Palestinian peoples in the name of the self-defense of the Israeli state. These are the kind of claims that need to be demystified, that need to be called into question, not because our Jewish brothers and sisters are less precious than Palestinian brothers and sisters. I proceed on the notion that our precious Palestinian baby has exactly the same value as a precious Israeli baby, and a precious Israeli baby has exactly the same value as a precious Palestinian baby. And therefore, I think we know in this country, we certainly know in the world, that if there were a Palestinian occupation of Jews, if there were a Palestinian ethnic cleansing of Jews, if there were a Palestinian dispossession of land of Jews, there would be massive solidarity with Jewish brothers and sisters against Palestinian power at the time. We know that. This is where racism comes in. This is where the xenophobia comes in. All we're asking for is the golden rule. That's how you keep it moral. We're asking for the golden rule. Let us treat our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters in exactly the same way as we would treat our Jewish brothers and sisters if it were the other way around. And when you raise the question in that way, the hypocrisy begins to be more and more apparent. And lo and behold, we begin to see, this is a question of power, arbitrary power. And yet we know every domination, every occupation, every subjugation, arbitrary power at the top that rationalizes the use of its arbitrary power by either dehumanizing its victims, rendering the suffering of the victims invisible, or acting as if they don't matter, they don't count. And that's where the righteous indignation ought to begin. The very notion that any peoples subjugated, dominated, don't count. The very idea that Palestinians don't count and don't matter needs to be shattered. Not just called into question in a Socratic way, but shattered in our lens through which we view the world. And this is true for oppressed people all around the world. We talk about Kashmir, we talk about Tibet, we could talk about Sub-Saharan Africa and the Moroccan occupation. We could talk about Kashmir, There's a number of different examples of occupation that need to be radically called into question. But when it comes to U.S. policy, $4 billion going to the state of Israel that renders the suffering of Palestinians invisible, any kind of dialogue of the Israeli-Palestinian so-called conflict rather than settler colonial history, rather than asymmetric of relation of power, that is where we have to begin our dialogue. The narrative must begin with the realities on the ground and the massive suffering and misery of a occupied, dominated, subjugated, precious folk, my precious Palestinian brothers and sisters. And it's hard in the Black community to make that case. We've got so many Black leaders who are really in some ways bought off, in other ways blind, in other ways scared, in other ways intimidated to speak the truth about the plight and predicament of Palestinians. And that condition of truth is always to allow the suffering of oppressed to be heard, not because the voices of the oppressed have some monopoly on truth. No, oppressed peoples have their own forms of lies, their own forms of mendacity, their own forms of blindness. But you have to keep track of the suffering. And when all of those voices are heard, then you're going to get calls for resistance. This is why support of BDS is so very important. It gets many of us in deep trouble, but I don't mind being in deep trouble when I have moral and spiritual grounds to stand on. We have to have nonviolent forms of resistance that must be global, that puts pressure on the elites in the American empire to ensure that Palestinian suffering is not rendered invisible. So BDS, again, it's not going to be a matter of some kind of cheap anti-Semitism or losing sight of the precious humanity of Jews and Israelis. No, not at all. It's to bring power and pressure to bear so that Palestinian suffering is not downplayed, overlooked, devalued, that they stand like all humanity with their back straightened up, and having a right, not just to self-determination, but to live lives of decency and dignity, which is to say democratic accountability, which is to say some control over their skies, their borders, their land, their homes, their schools, their laws. And I'm a radical Democrat, small d, when it comes to all oppressed people. I come from a people whose very anthem is lift every voice, lift every echo. We don't want just voiced echoes expressed coming out of echo chambers, extensions of silos. No, when you lift your voice, you are critical, you are compassionate, and most importantly, and I'll bring this to a close because I really want this to be dialogical. Of course, Black culture is rooted in call and response, rooted in polyphonic exchange and cacophony of voices bouncing off against one another like a jazz jam session. And that's what we're about to have here. We're going to have a jazz jam session with my Palestinian brothers, highlighting what the ways in which we can attempt to empower, enable, and ennoble and cast a spotlight on the plight and predicament of Palestinians. But the one last point I do want to make is that courage has got to be at the center of it. Courage is the enabling virtue for all the other virtues. I mean, as a Christian, my own virtues, faith, hope, love. But without courage, they're sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. They're empty. They're empty. Now, love ought to embrace courage. Faith ought to embrace courage. Hope ought to embrace courage. But we have to highlight courage because the complicity to forms of ideology, Zionist and otherwise, that lose sight of the humanity of precious Palestinians has to be called into question. The conformity must be called into question, and the cowardliness of any leaders, Black spokespersons, Many of them tied to APEC. Many of them tied to Jewish lobbies. Jewish brothers and sisters have a right to have lobbies. We have a right to tell the truth about the ways in which they co-opt Black leadership. That's what it is to have a serious conversation about people who are suffering. We need more Black voices doing that on moral and spiritual grounds, whatever the cost, whatever the consequences for your career, whatever the risks you have to take for your reputation. Frederick Douglass, Ida B. Wells Barnett, Martin King, Malcolm X, they weren't obsessed with their reputation as it related to a liberal establishment. They were concerned about truth. They were concerned about justice. They were concerned about freedom, not just on the chocolate side of town in the American Empire, but oppressed people all around the world. Now, more and more recognized since 1948 and 1967. I thank my dear brother Edward Zayed for playing such an important role in making this visible, but there's a whole host of other great voices, Palestinian and sometimes non-Palestinian, like the Noam Chomskys of the world, to say, look, we need a genuine understanding of what's going on in the Middle East between Jews and non-Jews, between Jews and Arabs, between Jews and Palestinians. Let's get the story right. Let's get the narrative right. And then say, what are we going to do about it? Courage to speak the truth. Courage to be in solidarity. Courage to cut against the grain. Courage to expose the lies. Courage to expose the crimes. To be honest about the relation between the mendacity and the criminality, and then to act, to be in solidarity with those Palestinian voices that are saying, these are the things that must be done in order for our suffering to be rendered more visible. That's what PDS is all about. That's what it's all about. I had wonderful dialogues with my dear brother, Bernie Sanders, who would not support PDS. We argued about it, and I have deep love for my brother. I just said, you're wrong. You got to be consistent, my brother. You've got to be consistent. And we have to push that more and more. And of course, there's good news in terms of an awakening taking place among many young Americans of all colors and all classes and sexual orientation, including young Jewish students from If Not Now to a host of other folk concerned about serious critiques of Jewish Israeli domination and occupation. So there's good news on that front. But we got a long way to go. But let me stop there, Brother Muhammad, stop there, Brother Zayed, and let me take any questions and queries. And I deeply, deeply appreciate you all having me here or bringing me back, as it were. A number of 4 or 5 years ago, I was blessed to give the lecture on my dear brother Edward Zayed.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. West. I mean, this is truly inspiring, truly compelling. I mean, you laid out the interconnectedness of Black and Palestinian struggles. It really is a long saga, if you wish, of connectedness in the good sense. It's been around for a long time. You know, Malcolm X, Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, before he changed his name, and so on, others. And definitely laid out most recently in so many books and so on. Angela Davis's book comes to mind. You know, The Struggle is Constant and so on, from Palestine to Ferguson and so on, in which you commented on the book at one point. So it is really deeply rooted and strong. I mean, despite what was said about, in any community there are those who are reluctant for a number of reasons, but there are always those who are in the forefront and daring to speak and have the courage and the moral courage and have the love and the faith, as you spoke about. Also, you mentioned, the hate, the victims of hate. Ironically enough, the FBI's own report that was published on October 25th, and it showed that hate crimes are on the rise, 12,000 hate crimes in the year 2020, and a 16% jump over 2019. And the overwhelming majority of hate crimes against Black people. And then, Muslims and Jewish Americans and Hispanic Americans and you know, Asian Americans and so on. So it is a problem that is on the rise, unfortunately, all this. So all this that you talked about is truly inspiring. And if I were to pose a question to you, and in fact, it was crafted by my colleague and friend, comrade, our you know, both our comrades, Edmund Garibani, he wanted to ask you that you were recently, you criticized Harvard University, for denying you academic tenure and not even starting the tenure process. If he says, if I'm not wrong, you were previously tenured and held the highest academic rank, which is a university professor. That means it had nothing to do with academic merit, or age or anything like this, you know. So would you care to share with us, sir, you know, what really happened?
Yeah, I mean, it was clear to me, based on an explanation tied to the best evidence available, that there was a pattern of not considering or denying tenure to persons who are in deep solidarity with the Palestinian cause. I was not the only one. There was a Jewish Israeli sister who's written a powerful critique of Israeli domination and occupation who was denied tenure. There's another Muslim brother who was denied tenure. So when I came along, who had a university professorship in 1994, now that's a position of only 20 professors out of 2,000. I'm a university professor in 1994, but I can't even be considered for tenure 26 years later. If it's age, then okay, fine. Show me how I'm getting to see now. I want to see the evidence and what have you. But my class is still strong. I've got the Gifford lectures coming up in Scotland, which is a highly prestigious lectureship. They don't think I'm too old. And if it's academic, then let's look at my 22 books and 13 edited books. And why would you give me a university professorship many years ago based on academic excellence? Now, all of a sudden, I'm not even worthy of a tenure review. So it's a joke. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, you gotta be, you have a tragic comic sensibility and a sense of humor about this. You know, that the power elites, whoever they are, you know, they're ludicrous in terms of their cheap rationalizations of their status and power. But at the same time, you have to be very honest and candid about the fact that it has a facticity. It's there, and they can do anything they want. You know, they say what they want and get away with it, lie about you and get away with it, do what they want and get away with it, and say, well, we believe that resistance and resilience means you're not going to get away with it. You're not going to mistreat folk. You're not going to lie about them. You're not going to deny them tenure based on their particular stance as it relates to the Palestinian cause. Now, people would come back and say, well, you don't have direct evidence. Well, they're right about that. I don't have the emails. I don't have the conversations that are recorded. I see the pattern of behavior. There's nothing else to fall back on to account for why I did not undergo a tenure review other than my Palestinian views. I was the proud faculty advisor for the Palestinian students. We had wonderful dialogues year after year after year with the need of security, because, you know, it's a taboo issue in many ways. And yet the persuasiveness of the critiques of the vicious Israeli occupation and domination is expanding. And the Israeli elites know that. They know that they're losing that intellectual and ideological battle. They're winning it with the political elites, because the political elites are cowardly. They don't want to face the truth. They want to remain entrenched. But we know truth crushed to earth will rise again. Our challenge, as you know, my dear brother, is to stay on the moral and spiritual ground. You see, this has nothing to do whatsoever with any kind of a hatred of Jewish peoples or anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish prejudices. It has everything to do with a hatred of Israeli domination, a hatred of Israeli occupation. That's everything to do with a genuine love for the Palestinian brothers and sisters. And I've said on so many occasions that nothing will ever stand in the way or between my love for oppressed peoples. Jewish peoples are oppressed, deep love for them. Palestinians oppressed, deep love for them. Black folk oppressed, deep love for them. We could end up with a black face of the American empire like Obama. I'm going at him with righteous indignation because he ends up facilitating the rationalization of Israeli occupation. That's a moral stance. I mean, as a Christian, you try to love everybody, but you have a tilt toward the least of these. You have a tilt toward the oppressed. So that the attempt to cast me and so many other black folk as, you know, anti-Jewish and anti-Semite is ridiculous. It's ludicrous. And yet that's a risk you have to take and say, hey, push it aside and say nothing's going to stand in the way for me taking a stand, raising my voice, doing all that I can to ensure that Palestinian dignity and humanity and sanctity is affirmed.
Yes, indeed. It is something that those who speak the truth on the Palestinian issue on college campuses and academia, professors. I mean, I teach a course at American University. There's always something that, you know, some issues that you are not even supposed to discuss or talk about and so on. And it is because the Israeli occupation is, more and more is being exposed to the brutal system that it is and so on, especially in America. You mentioned BDS. You mentioned a lot of things that are happening. We also see this, you know, sort of crazy pursuit of Palestinian human rights organizations. Only last Friday, on Friday the 22nd, and the Israeli authorities banned six human rights Palestinian organizations. And and where is the outrage in the U.S.? The State Department says, "Go ask the Israelis why they did that. We support human rights and so on." So there's a frontal attack, you know, wide attack on all these issues. And as you mentioned, it really takes a great deal of courage. It takes a great deal of standing behind your position to move forward. So, and we have seen some changes in the country at large. I mean, we see it in the Democratic Party, we see it in Congress and so on. But do you see, fundamental change, among the black leadership, black political leadership in this country? Are we likely to see it? Because we have seen, we see what happened in Congress. We saw the victory of Jamal Bowman in New York, Cori Bush in Missouri and so on. But are we going to see more and more of these courageous stance?
Well, I hope so. You know, you can never predict the history, the Cassandra of syndrome here. It's hard to know where we're headed. I mean, I think that there's some very strong neo-fascist tendencies and waves and forces in our society. Trump is just a sign and a symptom and a symbol of that. And if we continue to move in that direction, then even the progressive black voices and other progressive voices will have to be stronger than ever. You know, the great Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel used to say in the 60s that the strongest ecumenical movement in the world was nihilism. Nihilism is a facilitator of fascism. It's the view that might makes right. It's the view that power determines what is moral. It's the view that you manipulate and dominate in order to get what you want, and all the Ten Commandments pushed aside, and it's just thou shalt not get caught of the survival of the slickest. And that's exactly what we're seeing. The backdrop is predatory capitalist economy. The backdrop is the rule of big money and big military. And the backdrop is to convince people that there is no alternative to the status quo. If you think of the history of U.S. policy toward Israel, has always been, there is no alternative to what the Israeli government says. no alternative. And any alternative that emerges must be terroristic, must be anti-Semitic, and so forth. And that's what needs to be shattered, because that's the trap. That's where people feel despairing and despondent, don't want to fight, and therefore end up well-adjusted to injustice and well-adapted to indifference. But we have to be very honest, my brother, that when it comes to politics, the neo-fascists are escalating, and the neoliberals in the Democratic Party are running scared because they are so intimidated and they're so frightened. And they usually are milquetoast and have very little backbone, especially when it comes to policies toward Israel. So that I hope there will be more Cory Bushes. I hope there will be more Brother Bowmans and others coming out of the Black community. But even if we don't, in our social movements, we've got stronger voices. And that's outside of electropolitics.
Right. So that is basically, I think that's going to be the game changer. You know, that is going to be the game changer. And I think, you know, maybe, you know, I pose this question to you. Yeah. I think there may be some, you know, big holes or gaps in the Palestinians' abilities to reach out to their brothers and sisters in the Black community and Black groups and maybe Black churches and so on. What are the avenues that are best can transport the Palestinians' connectedness with Black Americans? What are the ways and means that should be pursued by, let's say, Palestinian academics, activists, whoever?
I think the freest Black people in America are often the artists, are often the musicians, are often those who are willing to authorize an alternative reality based on an alternative vision. And so I think when we talk about Palestinian and Black solidarity, we've got to talk much more about the artists, especially among the youth. I mean, if we get artistic voices that are telling the truth about the plight and predicament of Palestinians, the shaping of the climate of opinion, the shaping of the lens through which people view the world, especially young people, that can have a strong impact. As much as some of the activists on the street. You need both. You need the activists on the street going to jail, raising their voices, organized, bringing power and pressure to bear, then being able to elect, you know, some progressive politician like your sister Rashida. You know, she calls our come running to Detroit because her voice is so very important, especially on this Black-Palestinian dialogue. But we need more artists who are spokespersons, who exercise a fearless speech and an unintimidated speech, a frank, plain speech. And I would like to see more stress on the artists. I know if John Coltrane was still around and Curtis Mayfield was still around, they would be singing about the relation of the Black and the Palestinian connection. Why? Because it's a moral and a spiritual issue.
Excellent. I have my brother Muhammad here. You want to ask the question directly, or you? Yeah, please go ahead. Yeah, sure. He would like to ask the question directly to you.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Another question we have for you is, the South African apartheid regime collapsed relatively fast after U.S. sanctions. What do you think it will take for the same to happen with Israel? How long do you think it will take? Obviously, it's always hard to predict the future, but, Israel is different from South Africa in some ways, whether it's the lobby or other influence propping it up. So how do you see that moving forward with, you know, the most recent political developments and with changing attitudes, opinions, et cetera?
Yeah, wonderful question. I mean, there's no doubt that there are some very important similarities between the apartheid-like structures, not just in South Africa, but American apartheid, too, up until the 1960s. Now, of course, when you talk about the Palestinian situation, you got a number of different groups. You got some precious Palestinians on the inside of Israel, you got Palestinians under occupation, you got Palestinians in the diaspora, and so forth. And each one of those have to be talked about in light of their specificity. So it's not just a homogenizing Palestinian community all there in one space, in one territory, as it were. In South Africa, you see, what you had once, though, you had greedy corporate elites in the United States who simply wanted to make money. And so they wanted to engage in constructive engagement with South African apartheid. You didn't have Afrikaner groups that were connected to the states that had strong and persuasive arguments or had enough might to shape U.S. policy. You see, in the situation of Israel, you see, you've got Jewish Americans, given all of their ideological diversity and political heterogeneity, in the United States, many of whom with significant power, significant wealth, significant influence, are able to make it difficult for the truth to come out in terms of the narrative, to make it difficult for legislation to take place in state legislatures as well as Congress, and make it difficult for there to be a uninhibited, robust conversation in the universities and colleges. Now, that's changing. That's changing. And you see, you know, my argument is that, you know, the right-wing Jewish brothers and sisters, they have a right to be wrong. We just had to point out they're wrong, because I believe you have to have an argument. You have to have a dialogue and so forth. But when it's very clear that, unlike the South African situation, where you didn't have Afrikaners, that those who were pro-Afrikaner in the United States in powerful positions to make it difficult to have a serious dialogue, make it difficult to push policy. In the situation of Israel, there's Israeli allies in the United States who so often want to trump, foreclose, preclude serious conversation, casting a light on the oppressive policies of the Israeli government. And they'll cast it as anti-Semitic over and over and over again. They'll call you a conspiracy theorist when you simply acknowledge there's Jewish brothers and sisters in the American empire who have significant wealth and power and influence. That's not conspiratorial at all. That's a fact. It's a fact. It doesn't mean they're coordinating every moment that somehow that all of them are on the same page. But when it comes to Israeli policies, there's an overlapping consensus. That's what AIPAC understands so very well. But AIPAC is not the only one. And so we have to be honest about that. And at the same time, we have to be vigilant in our bringing power and pressure to bear on any wealth, power, influence, non-Jewish, Jewish, white, black, Asian, whatever it is, because we're looking at this through moral and spiritual lens. When you look at it through moral and spiritual lens, you're not talking about just skin pigmentation. You're not just talking about ethnic identity. You're talking about what is true, what is just, what is moral, and in the end, how do we facilitate the freedom of everybody?
That's very well said, perfectly put.
Dr. West, I would like to ask you one last question, if I may. I
mean,
you're a philosopher, you're a public intellectual, you're a radical revolutionary, you're also, you call yourself a Christian revolutionary, or Christian radical, and so on. Now, we know, of course, that we know what to say the evangelical position is, but on the other hand, there are so many churches and so many religious trends in America that are really progressive, and so on. But we're unable to unlock, you know, this, to connect with the other Palestinians, are unable to connect with these groups. And indeed, with intellectuals, especially Jewish intellectuals, is the question that I asked our friend and brother in the struggle, Peter Beinart, who has written about this extensively and so on. So it's how could we best inculcate this great deal, you know, this reservoir of support and goodwill.
Well, I mean, one, you know, any quest for truth and beauty, goodness, the holy, or justice is always going to have major impediments. You mentioned Brother Peter. You know, Brother Peter is someone who underwent transformation. He underwent a metamorphosis. He engaged in a quest for truth and recognized he had strong blind spots. There were splinters in his eyes, like in all of our eyes, and he changed his mind. That's a beautiful thing. That's happening all the time. We have to push that over and over and over again. I think that the it's a good thing to see these churches, some of the mainline churches, some of the other denominations as well, raising deep questions about what does it mean to follow a Palestinian Jew named Jesus of Nazareth when he goes into the temple and runs out the money changers in the name of poor people. That temple was the largest edifice west of Rome with 400 troops protecting, tied to bankers and intellectuals who were rationalizing the economic exploitation of the poor. But that's the Jesus who was crucified. That's the reason why he was crucified. And so you say to yourself, well, how do you follow someone like that and not end up being in solidarity with Palestinians vis-a-vis Israeli domination and occupation? Why do you go all the way up to the line, go to the well, drink the water, follow through on that Jesus running those folk out? Did he run them out because they were Jews? Did he run them out because there was Samaritans? Did he know he ran them out because they were exploiting the poor? They were dominating and oppressing people. He was had a moral and a spiritual message and deed, and he was willing to love the poor to such a degree that he is crucified as a political criminal in the largest empire in the history of the world, in the western side of the globe, up until the British Empire and now the American Empire. How can you be a Christian and not anti-imperialist, not anti-colonial, not anti-occupation, not anti-domination? What kind of Jesus are you following? Reread Dietrich Bonhoeffer's The Cost of Discipleship, as that Lutheran pastor resisted against the name Hitler and was willing to be executed April 9th, 1945 in the name of his discipleship of Jesus against such an ugly fascist Hitler. Him. That's the spirit of the kind of Christianity I'm talking about, brother. And in the United States, it has been most manifest with Black people, most enacted by Black Christians. And in the end, those who have been willing to serve and sacrifice in the name of truth, in the name of justice, and do it with a smile and style. Ain't no ugly hatred here. This is a righteous indignation against domination and occupation. How could we not embrace and be in solidarity with our precious Palestinian brothers and sisters?
You have been listening to Professor Cornell West giving the keynote address at the annual conference of the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and the same place. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound editor, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts wishing you a good morning. تسكنه